Chapter 21. Was worse and had asked for me. I jumped into the nearest car, and 10 minutes later was running up the doctor's greasy stairs. To my dismay, I found Don Egidio's room cold and untenanted. But I was reassured a moment later by the appearance of the levatress, who announced that S.E. had transferred the blessed man to her own apartment, where he could have the sunlight and a good bed to lie in. There in fact he lay, weak but smiling, in a setting which contrasted oddly enough with his own monastic surroundings. A cheerful grimy room, hung with anecdotic chromos, photographs of lady patients proudly presenting their offspring to the camera, and innumerable Neapolitan santalini decked out with shriveled palm leaves. The levatress whispered that the good man had the pleurisy, and that, as she phrased it, he was nearing his last milestone. I saw that he was in fact in a bad way, but his condition did not indicate any pressing danger, and I had the presentiment that he would still, as the saying is, put up a good fight. It was clear, however, that he knew what turn the conflict must take, and the solemnity with which he welcomed me showed that my summons was a part of that spiritual strategy with which the Catholic opposes the surprise of death. "My son," he said, when the levatress had left us, "I have a favor to ask you. You found me yesterday bidding goodbye to my best friend. His coffin interrupted him. I have never told you," he went on, "the name of the family in which I was brought up. It was Siviano, and that was the grave of the Count's eldest son, with whom I grew up as a brother. For 18 years he has lain in that strange ground in Terra Aliena, and when I die, there will be no one to care for his grave. I saw what he waited for. I will care for it, Signor Paracco. I knew I should have your promise, my child. And what you promise you keep. But my friend is a stranger to you, you are young, and at your age life is a mistress who kisses away sad memories. Why should you remember the grave of a stranger? I cannot lay such a claim on you. But I will tell you his story, and then I think that neither joy nor grief will let you forget him, for when you rejoice you will remember how he sorrowed, and when you sorrow the thought of him will be like a friend's hand in yours. Two, you tell me," Don Egidio began, "that you know our little lake, and if you have seen it, you will understand why it always used to remind me of the garden enclosed of the canticles. Hortus inclusus, columba me informinibus petri colon." The words used to come back to me whenever I returned from a day's journey across the mountains, and looking down saw the blue lake far below, hidden in its hills like a happy secret in a stern heart. We were never envious of the glory of the Great Lakes. They are like the show pictures that some nobleman hangs in his public gallery, but our Iseo is the treasure that he hides in his inner chamber. You tell me you saw it in summer, when it looks up like a saint's eye, reflecting the whole of heaven. It was then, too, that I first saw it. My future friend, the old Count, had found me at work on one of his fruit farms up the valley, and hearing that I was ill-treated by my stepfather, a drunken peddler from the Val Mastellin, whom my poor mother a year or two earlier had come across at the fair of Lavier, he had taken me home with him to Iseo. I used to serve mass in our hill village of Cerveno, and the village children called me "he little priest," because when my work was done I often crept back to the church, to get away from my stepfather's blows and curses. I will make a real priest of him," the Count declared. And that afternoon, perched on the box of his traveling carriage, I was whirled away from the dark scenes of my childhood into a world where, as it seemed to me, everyone was as happy as an angel on a precipio. I wonder if you remember the Count's villa? It lies on the shore of the lake, facing the green knoll of Monte Isola, and overlooked by the village of Siviano, and by the old parish church, where I said mass for 15 happy years. The village hangs on a ledge of the mountain, but the villa dips its foot in the lake, smiling at its reflection like a bather lingering on the brink. What paradise it seemed to me that day! In our church up the valley there hung an old brown picture, with a Saint Sebastian in the foreground. and behind him the most wonderful palace, with terraced gardens adorned with statues and fountains, where fine folk in resplendent dresses walked up and down without heeding the blessed martyr's pangs. The Count's villa, with its terraces, its roses, its marble steps descending to the lake, reminded me of that palace, only instead of being inhabited by wicked people engrossed in their selfish pleasures, it was the home of the kindest friends that ever took a poor lad by the hand. The old Count was a widower when I first knew him. He had been twice married, and his first wife had left him two children, a son and a daughter. The eldest, Donna Mariana, was then a girl of 20, who kept her father's house, and was a mother to the two lads. She was not handsome or learned, and had no taste for the world, but she was like a lavender plant in a poor man's window, just a little gray flower, but a sweetness that fills the whole house. Her brother, Count Roberto, had been ailing from his birth, and was a studious lad with a melancholy, musing face such as you may see in some of Titian's portraits of young men. He looked like an exiled prince dressed in mourning. There was one child by the second marriage, Count Andrea, a boy of my own age, handsome as a Saint George, but not as kind as the others. No doubt, being younger, he was less able to understand why an uncouth peasant lad should have been brought to his father's table, and the others were so fearful of hurting my feelings that, but for his teasing, I might never have mended my clumsy manners or learned how to behave in the presence of my betters. Count Andrea was not sparing in such lessons, and Count Roberto, in spite of his weak arms, chastised his brother roundly when he thought the discipline had been too severe. But for my part, it seemed to me natural enough that such a godlike being should lord it over a poor clodhopper like myself. Well, I will not linger over the beginning of my new life, for my story has to do with its close. Only I should like to make you understand what the change meant to me, an ignorant peasant lad, coming from hard words and blows, and a smoke-blackened hut in the hills, to that great house full of rare and beautiful things, and of beings who seemed to me even more rare and beautiful. Do you wonder I was ready to kiss the ground they trod, and would have given the last drop of my blood to serve them? In due course I was sent to the seminary at Lodi, and on holidays I used to visit the family in Milan. Count Andrea was growing up to be one of the handsomest young men imaginable, but a trifle wild, and the old Count married him in haste to the daughter of a Venetian noble, who brought as her dower a great estate in Istria. The Countess Gemma, as this lady was called, was as light as thistledown, and had an eye like a baby's. But while she was cooing for the moon, her pretty white hands were always stealing toward something within reach that she had not been meant to have. The old Count was not alert enough to follow these maneuvers, and the Countess hid her designs under a torrent of guileless chatter, as pickpockets wear long sleeves to conceal their movements. Her only fault, he used to say, was that one of her aunts had married an Austrian, and this event having taken place before she was born, he laughingly acquitted her of any direct share in it. She confirmed his good opinion of her by giving her husband two sons, and Roberto showing no inclination to marry, these boys naturally came to be looked on as the heirs of the house. Meanwhile, I had finished my course of studies, and the old Count, on my 21st birthday, had appointed me priest of the parish of Siviano. It was the year of Count Andrea's marriage, and there were great festivities at the villa. 3 years later the old Count died, to the sorrow of his two eldest children. Donna Mariana and Count Roberto closed their apartments in the palace at Milan, and withdrew for a year to Siviano. It was then that I first began to know my friend. Before that I had loved him without understanding him. Now I learned of what metal he was made. His bookish tastes inclined him to a secluded way of living, and his younger brother perhaps fancied that he would not care to assume the charge of the estate. But if Andrea thought this, he was disappointed. Roberto resolutely took up the tradition of his father's rule, and, as if conscious of lacking the old Count's easy way with the peasants, made up for it by a redoubled zeal for their welfare. I have seen him toil for days, to adjust some trifling difficulty that his father would have set right with a ready word. Like the sainted bishop who, when a beggar asked him for a penny, cried out, colon, alas, my brother, I have not a penny in my purse, but here are 2 gold pieces, if they can be made to serve you instead. We had many conferences over the condition of his people, and he often sent me up the valley to look into the needs of the peasantry on the fruit farms. No grievance was too trifling for him to consider it, no abuse too deep-seated for him to root it out, and many an hour that other men of his rank would have given to books or pleasure was devoted to adjusting a quarrel about boundary lines, or to weighing the merits of a complaint against the tax collector. I often said that he was as much his people's priest as I, and he smiled and answered that every landowner was a king, and that in old days the king was always a priest. Donna Mariana was urgent with him to marry, but he always declared that he had a family in his tenantry, and that, as for a wife, as he had never let him feel the want of one. He had that musing temper which gives a man a name for coldness, though in fact he may all the while be storing fuel for a great conflagration. But to me, he whispered another reason for not marrying. A man, he said, does not take wife, and rejoice while his mother is on her deathbed. And Italy, his mother, lay dying, with the foreign vultures waiting to tear her apart. You are too young to know anything of those days, my son, and how can anyone understand them who did not live through them? Italy lay dying indeed. But Lombardy was her heart, and the heart still beat, and sent the faint blood creeping to her cold extremities. Her torturers, weary of their work, had allowed her to fall into a painless stupor, but just as she was sinking from sleep to death, heaven sent Radetzky to scourge her back to consciousness, and at the first sting of his lash she sprang maimed and bleeding to her feet. Ah, those days, my son! Italy, Italy was the word on our lips, but the thought in our hearts was just Austria. We clamored for liberty, unity, the franchise, but under our breath we prayed, only to smite the white coats. Remove the beam from our eye, we cried, and we shall see our salvation clearly enough. We priests in the north were all liberals, and worked with the nobles and the men of letters. Gaiberti was our breviary and His Holiness the new Pope was soon to be the tankard of our crusade. But meanwhile, mind you, all this went on in silence, underground as it were, while on the surface Lombardy still danced, feasted, married, and took office under the Austrian. In the iron mines up our valley there used to be certain miners who stayed below ground for months at a time. And, like one of these, Roberto remained buried in his purpose, while life went its way overhead. Though I was not in his confidence, I knew well enough where his thoughts were, for he went among us with the eye of a lover, the visionary look of one who hears a voice. We all heard that voice, to be sure, mingling faintly with the other noises of life. But to Roberto it was already as the roar of mighty waters, drowning every other sound with its thunder. On the surface, as I have said, things looked smooth enough. An Austrian cardinal throned in Milan, and an Austrian-hearted pope ruled in Rome. In Lombardy, Austria couched like a beast of prey, ready to spring at our throats if we stirred or struggled. The moderates, to whose party Count Roberto belonged, talked of prudence, compromise, the education of the masses. But if their words were a velvet sheath, their thought was a dagger. For many years, as you know, the Milanese had maintained an outward show of friendliness with their rulers. The nobles had accepted office under the viceroy, and in the past there had been frequent intermarriage between the two aristocracies. But now, one by one, the great houses had closed their doors against official society. Though some of the younger and more careless, those who must dance, and dine at any cost, still went to the palace and sat beside the enemy at the opera, fashion was gradually taking sides against them, and those who had once been laughed at as old fogies, were now applauded as patriots. Among these, of course, was Count Roberto, who for several years had refused to associate with the Austrians, and had silently resented his easy-going brother's disregard of political distinctions. Andrea and Gemma belong to the Moth tribe, who flock to the brightest light, and Gemma's Istrian possessions, and her family's connection with the Austrian nobility, gave them a pretext for fluttering about the viceregal candle. Roberto let them go their way, but his own course was a tacit protest against their conduct. They were always welcome at the Palazzo Siviano, but he and Donna Mariana withdrew from society in order to have an excuse for not showing themselves at the Countess Gemma's entertainments. If Andrea and Gemma were aware of his disapproval, they were clever enough to ignore it. For the rich elder brother who paid their debts, and never meant to marry, was too important a person to be quarreled with on political grounds. They seemed to think that, if he married, it would be only to spite them, and they were persuaded that their future depended on their giving him no cause to take such reprisals. I shall never be more than a plain peasant at heart, and I have little natural skill in discerning hidden motives, but the experience of the confessional gives every priest a certain insight into the secret springs of action, and I often wondered that the worldly wisdom of Andrea and Gemma did not help them to a clearer reading of their brother's character. For my part, I knew that, in Roberto's heart, no great passion could spring from a mean motive, and I had always thought that, if he ever loved any woman as he loved Italy, it must be from his country's hand that he received his bride. And so it came about. Have you ever noticed, on one of those still autumn days before a storm, how here and there a yellow leaf will suddenly detach itself from the bough and whirl through the air, as though some warning of the gale had reached it? So it was then in Lombardy. All round was the silence of decay, but now and then a word, a look, a trivial incident, fluttered ominously through the stillness. It was in 45. Only a year earlier the glorious death of the Bandiera brothers had sent a long shudder through Italy. In the Romagna, Renzi and his comrades had tried to uphold by action the protest set forth in the Manifesto of Rimini, and their failure had sowed the seed which Diseglio and Cavour were to harvest. Everywhere the forces were silently gathering, and nowhere was the hush more profound, the least reverberation more audible, than in the streets of Milan. It was Count Roberto's habit to attend early mass in the cathedral, and one morning, as he was standing in the aisle, a young girl passed him with her father. Roberto knew the father, a beggarly Milanese of the noble family of Intelvi, who had cut himself off from his class by accepting an appointment in one of the government offices. As the two went by, he saw a group of Austrian officers looking after the girl, and heard one of them say, "Colin, such a choice morsel as that is too good for slaves," and another answer with a laugh, "Colin, yes, it's a dish for the master's table." The girl heard too. She was as white as a windflower, and he saw the words come out on her cheek like a red mark from a blow. She whispered to her father, but he shook his head, and drew her away without so much as a glance at the Austrians. Roberto heard mass, and then hastened out, and placed himself in the porch of the cathedral. A moment later the officers appeared, and they too stationed themselves near the doorway. Presently the girl came out on her father's arm. Her admirers stepped forward to greet Intelvi, and the cringing wretch stood there exchanging compliments with them, while their insolent stare devoured his daughter's beauty. She, poor thing, shook like a leaf, and her eyes, in avoiding theirs, suddenly encountered Roberto's. Her look was a wounded bird that flew to him for shelter. He carried it away in his breast, and its live warmth beat against his heart. He thought that Italy had looked at him through those eyes. For love is the wiliest of masqueraders, and has a thousand disguises at his command. Within a month Faustina Intolvi was his wife. Donna Mariana and I rejoiced, for we knew he had chosen her, because he loved her, and she seemed to us almost worthy of such a choice. As for Count Andrea and his wife, I leave you to guess what ingredients were mingled in the kiss with which they welcomed the bride. They were all smiles at Roberto's marriage, and had only words of praise for his wife. Donna Mariana, who had sometimes taxed me with suspecting their motives, rejoiced in this fresh proof of their magnanimity, but for my part I could have wished to see them a little less kind. All such twilight fears, however, vanished in the flush of my friend's happiness. Over some nature's love steals gradually, as the morning light widens across a valley, but it had flashed on Roberto like a leap of dawn to a snow peak. He walked the world with the wandering step of a blind man suddenly restored to sight, and once he said to me with a laugh, colon, love makes a Columbus of every one of us. And the Countess? The Countess, my son, was 18, and her husband was 40. Count Roberto had the heart of a poet, but he walked with a limp and his skin was sallow. Youth plucks the fruit for its color, rather than its flavor, and first love does not serenade its mistress on a church organ. In Italy, girls are married as land is sold. If two estates adjoin, two lives are united. As for the portionless girl, she is a knick-knack that goes to the highest bidder. Faustina was handed over to her purchaser, as if she had been a picture for his gallery, and the transaction doubtless seemed as natural to her as to her parents. She walked to the altar like an Iphigenia, but pallor becomes a bride, and it looks well for a daughter to weep on leaving her mother. Perhaps it would have been different if S.E. had guessed that the threshold of her new home was carpeted with love and its four corners hung with tender thoughts of her, but her husband was a silent Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.